Have you ever been walking down the street, like maybe you're heading to work in a booming city center and you walk past this old, slightly rundown one-story building?
Oh, yeah, sitting right in the middle of all these modern glass high-rises.
Exactly. It's sitting right there in the middle of a massive housing shortage next to busy transit stops, and you just stop and wonder, why hasn't someone built an apartment building there?
I mean, it's a question that completely defies basic supply and demand. You look at this incredibly valuable dirt, and you just think, well, something invisible must be stopping development.
Right. And today, for this deep dive, we're getting a map of that exact invisible force. We are looking at a really fascinating data-heavy report titled LA Historic Preservation, an Economic and GIS Study.
It's a really dense, fascinating read.
It really is. And our mission today is to uncover what this report calls the spatial signature of historic preservation. So we're going to figure out if Los Angeles is actually protecting its history, or if, historic preservation has basically just become a loophole to block housing and development exactly where the city needs it most.
It is a highly contentious topic, for sure. Though before we dive into the data, we should probably note that housing policy, gentrification, and development are, well, they're intensely debated political issues.
Oh, absolutely.
So for this deep dive, we aren't taking a side or endorsing any of these policies. We're just acting as your guides to unpack exactly what the data in this specific geographical study is arguing. That way, you can see the underlying mechanics of how these cities actually operate.
Right. Our goal is just to understand the machinery behind the curtain. And what makes this source so compelling is that it doesn't just rely on neighborhood anecdotes.
No, it looks at the hard numbers.
Exactly. It takes all 2,295 active historic cultural monuments, or HCMs, in Los Angeles, and it maps them against roughly 2,500 census tracts. It essentially gives us a mathematical footprint of where the physical past is occupying the present.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to understand the impact of these monuments, we first have to look at where they actually are. When I was reading through the methodology, it felt like they were taking an economic MRI of Los Angeles.
Oh, the MRI analogy is perfect.
Right. They scanned the entire city across four distinct metrics: land value, household income, jobs per resident, and crime.
And if historic preservation were purely about saving beautiful architecture, you would logically expect those monuments to be scattered fairly evenly across the city.
Because great architecture was built everywhere.
Exactly. So mathematically, if you divide the city into tiers based on real estate prices, say the bottom 30%, the middle 40%, and the top 30%, a completely random distribution of historical monuments would perfectly mirror that split.
But the scan shows a massive skew. Let's look at the actual land value. Over 54% of all these historic monuments sit in the top 30% most expensive tracts in the city.
Which is huge.
Yeah. Meanwhile, less than 10% sit in the bottom 30%. So the immediate takeaway from the data is that, well, preservation absolutely loves expensive dirt.
What's fascinating here is the why behind that concentration.
Yeah.
Because the data suggests a couple of mechanisms at play.
Okay, like what?
On one hand, developers really only target the most valuable land for new high-rises. So neighborhoods sitting on expensive dirt might use historic preservation defensively, as a tool to block developers.
I know that makes sense.
But on the other hand, wealthy landowners just often have the resources, the time, and the political capital to lobby for historic status in the first place to maintain their neighborhood's exclusivity.
Right, so the preservation status kind of chases the economic heat, and you actually see that same heat when you look at employment density. Nearly 41% of these monuments are concentrated in the top jobs-rich areas.
We are talking about places like downtown Hollywood, Koreatown.
Yeah, so they aren't just sitting on expensive residential land. They are anchored right where the economic engine of the city is roaring the loudest, right where people desperately need to live to, commute to work.
Right. And because these monuments are sitting in these incredibly dense, high-traffic economic hubs, you also see a spike in a completely different metric, which is the neighborhood crime rate.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, over 47% of these monuments are located in the highest crime tracts. Now, the study is very careful to clarify causality here.
Like, the historic monuments are not causing the crime.
Exactly. High crime rates in these specific tracts are simply downstream of intense urban density and transient populations. But the overlap means that preservation policy is heavily concentrated in neighborhoods that are already carrying a disproportionate law enforcement and civic load.
Right. It's a byproduct of the intense urban environment they're located in. But when you combine that high land value, the high job density, and the high urban density, it sets up an absolute paradox for the final metric of this economic MRI.
Income.
Yes, income. We just established that these buildings are sitting on the most valuable, expensive land in the city. But despite that, over 41% of these monuments are located in the lowest income tracts.
And that right there is the pivotal revelation of the entire macro study. When you synthesize those four data points together, you get what the study defines as the gentrification pressure signature.
Gentrification pressure signature.
Right. You have beautiful pre-war architecture sitting in working-class neighborhoods where the physical dirt beneath the buildings has skyrocketed in value, far past the financial capacity of the people actually living in the neighborhood.
It's just such a bizarre cross-section. High land value, high jobs, high crime, but low income. And because these historic buildings sit exactly at that intersection, they perfectly fuel two entirely contradictory political arguments.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the macro data we just discussed validates both sides of the preservation debate almost equally well.
How so?
Well, on the defense side, preservationists look at this gentrification pressure signature and say, look at the data. We are saving old working-class neighborhoods from corporate speculation.
But hold on, isn't that exactly what we'd want? If a private developer buys up a working-class neighborhood, they aren't going to build affordable housing out of the goodness of their hearts.
Right. They're going to bulldoze it and build luxury condos.
Exactly. So aren't these historic designations actually functioning as a shield, protecting vulnerable renters from being displaced?
That is exactly the narrative on one side. And the data certainly supports the idea that preservation stops immediate demolition. But the critique looks at the exact same data and reaches the opposite conclusion about the long-term effects.
Okay, what's their angle?
They argue that these monuments are artificially freezing the neighborhood in amber. By legally blocking higher-value land use like dense apartment buildings, exactly where market pressure and job density demand it, preservation creates what the study calls designation friction.
Designation friction. That sounds like putting a 15-mile-per-hour speed limit on a 6-lane highway.
That's a great way to visualize it.
Like the economic infrastructure demands speed and flow people need to move in to be near jobs, but the legal designation forces everything into a massive bottleneck.
Exactly. You have a massive, localized need for housing near these jobs, but the preservation status prevents the market from building up to meet that need. So what happens to the existing housing supply?
The price skyrockets.
You're right. The critique argues that this friction only drives the cost of living up even further for those low-income residents you were trying to protect. Because now wealthy newcomers are competing for the limited existing housing stock.
So the county-level view basically leaves us at a total standstill. Both narratives use the exact same data to prove their point.
Precisely. And the report acknowledges this deadlock. To figure out the actual economic impact happening on the ground, the study argues we have to abandon the macro bird's eye view. We have to zoom all the way down to the micro level, looking at individual streets, individual parcels of land, and individual buildings.
And here's where it gets really interesting. To test this roadblock theory, the deep dive takes us right into the Hollywood Community Plan area. They map out 536 specific monuments.
It's a huge sample.
Yeah. And reading through the section, the analogy that came to mind was a shaken champagne bottle. You have this explosive real estate demand, the champagne, and these individual historic buildings are acting like economic corks stuffed into the bottle.
Absorbing all that pressure, but refusing to pop.
Exactly.
And to measure just how tightly those corks are wedged in, the study built an economic model for redevelopment potential. They basically want to know the tangible cost of that designation friction.
Like, what would happen if the status was lifted?
Right. If this historic status were suddenly removed, what would this specific parcel of dirt actually be worth based on what could be built there today?
And to figure that out, they calculate an uplift multiple. As I understand it, they take the current value of the property and project how much it would jump if it were redeveloped to match the density and the tourism demand surrounding it.
Exactly. They're calculating the gap between what the land is currently doing and what the local economy desperately needs it to be doing. And they categorize these buildings based on how aggressively they're holding back development.
The specifics they provide are just staggering. They classify these buildings into categories like confirmed blockers, likely blockers, and trapped residential.
And we aren't talking about a 10 or 20% increase in potential value.
No, not at all. Take the Southern California Telephone Company Exchange over on South La Brea. The study classifies it as a likely blocker. Currently, it's a relatively small structure valued around $1.3 million.
Which is pretty low for that area.
Right. But its potential estimate if it were redeveloped to match the dense high-demand area around it, $9.1 million. That is a 7x uplift multiple.
It's acting as a massive cork. It is sitting on dirt that the market values near $10 million, but it is legally restricted from fulfilling that economic potential.
Just wild.
And you see these massive multipliers across highly famous properties, too. The Pacific Cinerama Dome Theater on Sunset Boulevard is listed as a possible blocker.
Oh, I know that building.
It's iconic, yes, but it is vastly underutilizing premium land. It has a 7.4x uplift potential, meaning its underlying land value could jump from roughly $1 million to over $7.5 million if the space above or around it were fully developed.
Wow.
Yeah, and the Charlie Chaplin Studios on La Brea has the exact same profile, a 7.4x multiplier.
And then there is the trapped residential category, which really illustrates the tension between private property and public housing needs.
Oh, definitely.
You have places like the C.E. Toberman Estate on Camino Palmero. It's a massive, beautiful old estate, but it's categorized as trapped residential. It's operating way below its economic potential, with a value that could jump from $1.3 million to $7.5 million.
So much wasted potential space.
Exactly. The dirt it sits on is basically screaming to be turned into a dense multifamily apartment complex, but it is legally trapped as a single-family, lower-density use.
And we have to highlight the profound irony this study points out regarding tourism in Hollywood. Because you would naturally assume that historic preservation in Hollywood is an absolute economic win because it drives tourism.
Right. People come to see the historic stuff.
Exactly. But the data shows a really complex split. While five of these historic buildings are actively contributing to the tourist experience, you know, acting as major anchors that draw people in, four are actively detracting from it.
Yes. The report calls out Roman Gardens on North Highland Avenue. It's sitting right in the middle of a high exposure tourist zone.
Uh-huh.
But the data shows it's either vacant or failing. So not only is it blocking dense housing, but it's actively creating a dead zone for the pedestrian experience. Tourists are just walking past an empty, underutilized building. It's not housing people, and it's not generating revenue for the local economy. It's just structurally stuck.
Which brings us to the ultimate question of the study. Now that we can see the exact mechanics of how individual buildings act as blockers or trapped residential uses in Hollywood, we have to look for systemic patterns.
Like, are these just isolated incidents? A few quirky old buildings holding out against developers? Or are they coordinated clusters actively choking the city's housing potential on a larger scale?
Right.
And this is where I find myself getting skeptical again. Because how do you objectively measure the cost of keeping a cool old building versus building, I don't know, a sterile glass apartment complex?
That's a fair question.
Architecture undeniably has cultural value. History has intangible value to a community. So how does a data study mathematically prove that keeping a historic building is somehow costing the city more than replacing it?
That is arguably the most difficult challenge in urban economics.
Yeah.
You really can't put a dollar value on cultural heritage, which is exactly why the study bypasses the emotional argument altogether and introduces a metric called the opportunity score. It looks strictly at spatial efficiency.
Walk us through how that actually works conceptually, because, I mean, the algebra in the report is pretty dense.
Think of the opportunity score like a massive citywide warning siren for spatial inefficiency. To get this score, the researchers essentially weighed two things against each other: how insanely expensive the dirt is, and how many jobs are right next door to it.
Okay, simple enough.
If a historic building is sitting on top-tier real estate and is surrounded by thousands of jobs, but it's legally frozen as a low-density one-story structure, well, the formula triggers a massive red flag.
Right.
That high opportunity score highlights exactly where the economic cost of preservation, the lost housing and lost density, is the most severe.
So a high score basically flashes red on the map, screaming, you know, this land is too valuable and too close to major job centers to be utilized this way.
Exactly. And when they ran this opportunity score formula across the entire city, they found 97 historic cultural monuments actively acting as severe blockers or trapping lower uses.
97 of them.
Yeah. And they aren't randomly dispersed. They actually cluster together into 8 specific opportunity zones.
Let's talk about where those zones are, because it paints a very clear picture of the city's bottlenecks. Zone 1 is Hollywood, which we just discussed. It has 20 of these blocking buildings sitting on top-tier land, with an average opportunity score of 57 out of a possible 110.
This is where Roman Gardens and the Cinerama Dome are acting as lead blockers.
Right. Then you have Zone 2, Westlake. It has 25 buildings actively causing severe designation friction. The lead blocker here is the famous Bullock's Wilshire Building.
It's an iconic piece of architecture, definitely. Mm-hmm. But spatially, it is sitting right in the middle of incredibly high-density needs, severely limiting the housing potential around it.
And Zone 3 is completely different, Eagle Rock and Highland Park. It's an opportunity zone built entirely around 8 buildings that are trapped in lower uses.
Yeah, the lead blockers here are clustered in Heritage Square.
Right. Places like the Valley Knutson Garden and the Octagon House, they have massive opportunity scores of 78. That means they are sitting on highly valuable land that is drastically under-delivering on housing relative to the local job market.
But the most revealing detail in the entire GIS map comes when you look at the neighborhood averages. We've talked a lot about Hollywood and downtown, yeah. You know, the urban core. But the highest average opportunity score by neighborhood isn't downtown.
Not even close. It's Brentwood and Bel Air, the absolute wealthiest, most exclusive enclaves on the west side of the city. They hit an astronomical average opportunity score of 107.
It's almost a perfect score for spatial inefficiency.
And it is entirely centered around a trapped use, the Cliff May Experimental House. You have land valued in the absolute highest decile, incredibly exclusive, and the preservation status is just trapping its use. And right behind it is West Hollywood, with an average score of 103, anchored by the C.E. Toberman Estate.
What this reveals is a profound shift in how we understand preservation. The absolute highest opportunity costs, the places where the corks are holding back the most intense economic pressure for housing, are actually in the wealthiest, most exclusive enclaves of the city.
Wow.
The preservation tool in these specific zones isn't saving a vulnerable working-class neighborhood from gentrification. It is legally locking in ultra-low density on the most expensive dirt in Southern California.
So what does this all mean? Obviously, this deep dive is hyper-focused on the specific geography of Los Angeles. But even if you don't live anywhere near Southern California, the underlying mechanics of this study really matter to you.
Absolutely.
Every major city in the world, from New York to London to Tokyo, uses some form of historic preservation. And what this data proves is that preservation is not just an aesthetic tool used to save beautiful pre-war architecture. It is a massive structural economic lever.
It really is.
It dictates where housing can go, it dictates who gets the privilege of living near the best jobs, and it artificially inflates how expensive land becomes by severely limiting what can be built on it.
This raises an important question, though. The study doesn't tell us what to do. It doesn't say we should tear down the Cinerama Dome or bulldoze the Octagon House.
Right. It's not a policy prescription.
Exactly. But it forces us to acknowledge the invisible tax of designation friction. When a city prioritizes the physical footprint of the past, it is making a deliberate mathematical choice to restrict the present-day density that a growing population desperately needs. We can no longer pretend that saving a historic building is a victimless or cost-free action.
And it leaves you wondering about the future, too. Right now, we're looking at old estates and theaters. But as remote work continues to permanently empty out traditional office spaces in these high-value downtown areas...
Oh, that's a really interesting point.
Right. Will the definition of historic preservation eventually be weaponized to protect mid-century office parks? Will these exact same preservation laws be used to stop us from turning those empty, obsolete skyscrapers into the affordable housing our cities actually need? It's a spatial puzzle every city is going to have to solve.